Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books podcast. My name is Michael Van, but you can call me Mike. Today I'll be speaking with Pierre Asselin, who is a professor of history and Dwight E. Stamford Chair in the History of U.S. Foreign Relations at San Diego State University. His books include A Bitter Peace, Washington, Hanoi, and the Making of the Paris Peace Agreement, published in 2002, and Hanoi's Road to the Vietnam War, 1954 to 1965, published in 2013. Today we'll be talking about Vietnam's American War, A History, which was published in, 2018 with Cambridge Press. So, Pierre, good morning and welcome to New Books in History.
It's an honor to be here, Mike. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I've known Pierre for a number of years, and it's really great conversationalist. So we always start off these podcasts asking about the historian and how you came to be a historian. I know you touch on this in the book. You have a really interesting origin story that involves Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah.
And a young, confused Quebecois boy. So tell me how the Quebecois hockey player came to be a specialist in the American War in Vietnam.
Yeah, it's worth discussing because, you know, with a very kind of francophone name working on Vietnam, there's always an assumption that I'm actually French from France and that, you know, I had relatives in the Dien Bien Phu campaign and so on and so forth. But I mean, you know, nothing could be further from the truth. I'm actually from Quebec City in Canada, born and raised in Quebec City. I'm very French Canadian, as Quebecois as you could have it. I grew up knowing nothing about Asia, knowing nothing about Asians. I mean, Quebec City when I was a kid was very, very homogenous. We were all white, we're all French speaking, we're all Catholic. There was one black kid in my grade school, and then there would be one Asian kid in my high school.
It's so different than contemporary Quebec, which
is
vibrantly multicultural.
Yeah, very, exactly. And that's the thing, right? Yeah. All of these changes happen within my generation.
Yeah.
But so I never had any kind of interest in Asia or much less in Vietnam, which I didn't know existed. But what happened was that in my last year of high school, I went to class one day and was essentially, the teacher told us that for our term papers, we'd be working on violence in the Western world. And the night before I happened to have watched the second installment of the Rambo movies where he goes back to Vietnam to rescue POWs. Now, I didn't know where he'd gone back. So I go to my teacher after class and I say, listen, sir, you know, I watched this movie last night. It's this guy Rambo killing a bunch of Chinese people. Maybe I can work on this war of the U.S. in China. And then he very politely proceeded to say something along the lines of, well, you know, Pierre, I'm pretty sure the U.S. never actually went to war against China. I think the war you're referencing is Vietnam. And maybe you want to work on that. And so I said, well, I don't know Vietnam. He goes, well, another reason to work on that. You can learn something new. And so I ended up, you know, researching this war in Vietnam I knew nothing about, wrote a 10-page paper entitled The Vietnam War, which was really about booby traps in the Vietnam War. You know, I still have the copy of the paper. It's almost embarrassing, but it's also kind of cute, right?
This was in high school?
This was last year, high school. Yeah.
Senior
year. Yeah. And so, but it kind of, you know, everything kind of went from there. Shortly after I was done with that paper and that course, Platoon came out. I went to see it in theaters, and I knew what they meant when they talked about the Tet Offensive. I knew what they meant when they mentioned napalm and the Viet Cong. And then I went to college, and
where did you do your undergrad?
I did my undergrad at York University in Toronto. So after high school, I left Quebec and I went to Toronto to work for a summer, essentially to work, make some money, but also kind of learn to speak English more adequately. And then while in Toronto, I started thinking about maybe going to university there. I'd been accepted into Laval University in history, Laval in Quebec City. But then while I was in Toronto that summer, I started looking into going to school in Toronto, again, thinking that, well, it might be good for me if I could stay here and again, you know, learn to speak English a little better. And so I ended up signing up for school at York University. They actually have a bilingual campus called Glendon College. So I ended up there for my undergrad. And Glendon was great because I could take courses in French or English. And so I started mostly first couple of years, mostly in French and eventually in English once I felt more comfortable. I majored in history. I focused on European history. But in the midst of all of this, I took a course on Asian history with an Asian guy who turned out to be Vietnamese. And from there, my interest in Vietnam really, really grew. And then the professor, that Vietnamese professor in question, at one point came to me and said, listen, you know, if you're really into Asian history and Vietnamese history, I could maybe get you some money to go and spend the summer in the U.S. to learn Vietnamese. There was a language program called SEASI, the Southeast Asian Studies Summer Institute. And he said, you know, maybe I could go there and then like really kind of start learning the language, which would really help me then understand the culture and the history better. And I liked Vietnam, I liked Asia, but not to that extent. But then I found out that coming summer, the institute was going to be held in Hawaii. So then I told my professor once, I thought, well, in that case, you know, maybe, yeah, I really want to learn Vietnamese. But anyway, so in the summer of 1988.
Yeah, and listeners, you may not know this, but both Pierre and I have lived a good portion of our lives in Hawaii. We're in California now, but.
Yeah. You were born in Hawaii and ended up living there for 25 years after. So in 88, I went to Honolulu, University of Hawaii, spent the summer studying Vietnamese. And from that moment on, I was kind of hooked. I mean, that's when I knew that I would stay in school for as long as I can, get a PhD, and make the study of Vietnam basically my life.
Yeah.
All because of Rambo.
I mean, in high school.
Yeah.
It's, and where did you do graduate work?
I did. So I did my master's at the University of Toronto. And then for my PhD, ended up applying to a bunch of schools that had good Vietnam programs. And then I got accepted with money at the University of Hawaii, which I was really happy about. Went back to Hawaii, got my PhD there, and then stayed there after I graduated and worked at three different schools over the span of almost 25 years after that, before moving to San Diego 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's start talking about the book. This is Vietnam's American War, and I already had one teacher, a high school teacher in a coffee shop, come up to me and say, that is the best title. I that is so simple, so graceful, and does such an important restructuring for most American readers, and my students need to think about it like that. So obviously there are scores and scores of books on the American War in Vietnam, or the Vietnam War, however you want to call it. With all due respect, why do we need another book on this war?
That's a, So, I mean, you know, I'd written a good amount about the war prior to writing this book. And this is really the book I've always wanted to write.
Oh, really?
It really is. Because it's that's the thing, right? I mean, when this Vietnamese professor as an undergrad impressed upon me the fact that, you know, that the war in Vietnam means something for Westerners, but it means something entirely different for the Vietnamese. And that's one of the reasons why he wanted me to learn Vietnamese, so I could basically learn to understand that war from this other perspective, from the perspective of the Vietnamese who lived through it and for whom it meant a lot more than it ever did to the French or the Americans, as much as it still means something to the Americans. And so I'd been, you know, I worked, my dissertation was about, you know, the negotiations to end the war. And I tried to present both sides, the American side and then the Vietnamese side. And then I wrote some more about what was happening in Vietnam during the war. But eventually I thought, you know, of all the books out there about the war, and you're right, I mean, there's hundreds if not thousands of them, no one has really tried to write kind of a history of the war from the other side, you know, which is simple enough, right? I mean, it's like a comprehensive history from beginning to end, but that really presents the perspective of America's enemies in the Vietnam War. That's really what I set out to do with this book, is to kind of decenter the Vietnam War, at least to de-Americanize the Vietnam War, and introduce, I guess, a Vietnamese voice in that discussion we've been having about the war. So you know, we call it the Vietnam War, but for the Vietnamese, this is the American War, hence the title. I mean, this is Vietnam's American War. Mm-hmm. Now, as you know, and your audience probably knows, I mean, you know, there are different Vietnamese factions involved in that war. And what I do in this particular book is really tell the story of the Vietnamese communist faction of America's enemies, as I was saying earlier.
You make a joke in the introductory chapter that when you're talking about the title, you say, besides Vietnam's American War, it makes for a much better title than the North Vietnamese Communist Leadership's War Against the American and South Vietnamese Presidential Leadership over Vietnam.
Yeah, exactly.
So this decenters the American perspective on the war.
Yeah.
Focuses on Hanoi, but you really are focused refocuses on Vietnam, but you really are focused on Hanoi and Hanoi's leadership circle, correct?
Exactly, right. I mean, so we have, and this is kind of, you know, intended to complement what we've been doing for so long in this country, right? Looking at Lyndon Johnson's war, mm-hmm. looking at Richard Nixon's war, right? I mean, mm-hmm. we in our efforts to kind of understand the American war in Vietnam, we've tried to make sense of exactly what American policymakers were thinking. I mean, they were the ones, after all, who made the big decisions that resulted in this very massive U.S. involvement in Vietnam. So what I've been trying to do for quite some time, what I try to do again comprehensively in this book, is present how their counterparts in Hanoi were approaching these same questions of dealing with the French, of implementing the Geneva Accords, and eventually of whether or not to make a move toward armed conflict to bring about Vietnamese national reunification.
Mm-hmm. And that's great and fantastic. And as someone who's worked in the Vietnamese archives, my immediate question is, how on earth do you get access to those documents? I mean, I started doing my research in Vietnam in the 1990s, and a totally safe subject, French colonialism, long before the Vietnamese achieved independence. And still, it took me well over a month to get into the archives, and I look like a CIA agent, I guess. So they were really sussing me out for a while, and eventually let me in. And it was very difficult to get documents. I mean, now it's much easier, much better, and especially in the new Archive Center One. But I'm working in pre-1954, and what everyone told me is, don't even think of asking for anything after 1954, and don't, you know, it's like the old Fawlty Towers skit, don't talk about the war. You know,
That's
just, that will get you on the radar screen, get you in trouble. So here you come along, You're Canadian, so maybe you got a bit more privilege there. But you come along and you're diving into some of the most sensitive topics. So how were you able to get access in Hanoi? And which archives did you work in?
The post 45 archive, post 54. But I think that's the thing that I think your audience needs to understand, right? Is that as much as we think the Vietnamese celebrate their remarkable victory over the United States, in Vietnam, it's not an easy topic to engage intellectually. The Vietnamese defeated the United States, and the authorities are very proud of this. The Communist Party is very proud of this. But for the average Vietnamese, there was really nothing good about that period. So many people died. So the party will have to create a certain narrative about the war that has to be consistent with itself and that cannot be challenged. And so. For Vietnamese scholars themselves, dealing with that subject matter is very, very difficult because the moment you introduce a new idea, the party is likely to kind of start paying attention to what you write and get in the way of what you do. It can be a little easier for foreign scholars, but then again, if the idea is to, present the Vietnamese perspective on the basis of Vietnamese source material, then you kind of encounter the same problem, and as you say, it's challenging because of that. Because ultimately, in tackling the U.S. war in Vietnam, you're likely to end up challenging this narrative that the party has been constructing and presenting for decades now. We have this archive in Hanoi, which is different from the one you've worked from. That essentially has in its custody the documents starting from the time Ho Chi Minh proclaims the independence of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. When you're looking at the period, the documents for 45 to 54, kind of, the return of the French, those are relatively easily accessible. When you get into the post-54 kind of American period, then it's a lot more challenging to get access to those materials, and as much as the archivists themselves want to help you, there are rules in place that are intended to I think deter scholars, Vietnamese and foreign, from really engaging that time period. So the first time I went to the archives in Hanoi, to this archive number 3 in Hanoi, was in the mid 90s when I was putting my dissertation together.
Do you remember what year?
I think it was in 1995. It was either 94 or 95.
Okay, so that was a year or two before I got there. But that was, for people who visited Vietnam, that was a very different Hanoi than the Hanoi you'll see today.
I mean, very,
very, very few cars. Still relatively few motorcycles at that point.
Yeah,
Motorcycles really took off about 97.
Yeah, and it's
bicycles and some Soviet trucks and no 6-foot white guys walking around.
No. I mean, I'd been to Vietnam. The first time I was there was 89. So there were white guys around, but they were almost
speaking Russian.
Exactly. They were, and everyone assumed I was Soviet at that point.
Yeah.
And then when I went back, I mean, it had changed a lot by the mid 90s. But as you say, it's relative to how Vietnam is today. I mean, it was a completely different country. I mean, you really felt like you were on a different planet. It wasn't just that you were in a different country. You felt, based on my limited traveling experience at the time, I remember like riding a bicycle and looking at the moon, and it was the first thing that looked familiar to me, in like 2 or 3 weeks. I went to Vietnam to research for my dissertation in, I think it was in 1995. I spent a good amount of my time just working at the National Library from published materials. And then I thought, well, I found out there was an archive and that you could technically access it. And I thought, okay, maybe I should try to get in there. And that's when I realized, wow, this is really tough, as people had suggested.
Was the archive headquarters adjacent to the library?
No, they were.
Okay. The Colonial Archive was. The pre-54 was there in the mid-90s.
Yeah, no, they were in a different part of town.
So there already been that separation of archives one, two, and three.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. One, the colonial archive in Hanoi. Yeah. Two, namely, like the archives of the former South Vietnamese regime in Saigon. City, and three, like the modern, the post 45 communist stuff in Hanoi. So so that archive was in a different part of town. And then I went there. And then I was told, okay, you can't just come in. You need a letter of introduction. And so then I went to the university that was sponsoring my visit at the time, Social Sciences, Humanities. And then I got that letter of introduction. So then I went back and then they said, okay, you got the introduction. What do you want to work on? I said, I want to work on the American War. Sorry, can't help you. And then they sent me home again. Then I went back to the university. I said, listen, you know, I had the letter, but then they said no. And then they said, and then that's when I got my first lesson into, you know, how sensitive the American war remains, especially from the standpoint of the authorities. So then it was suggested that instead of saying I'm going to work on the American war, I come up with a topic that looks more innocent. So I tried another topic, went back. They rejected again my application to enter, and eventually I settled on. Implementation of the Geneva Accords, and that got me in. Mm. But then, so I got in, and then I was really excited. But then I got I had to wait another couple of weeks because, you know, just seeing the index for the documents was going to take 2 weeks. And then I saw the index. I asked for documents, and then that took another month and a half. Yeah. I mean, it was such a slow process. And so
I remember this well.
Yeah.
I had spent a lot of time in the mid-90s just hanging out, waiting for my documents.
And that's the thing, you know, I mean, you're a grad student, so you figure, and I had time, which I was really lucky to have. So you feel insecure. You feel like, well, at least I got in. So you abide by what you're told, right? And then they tell you to come back in a month, you go back in a month, and then they tell you, well, come back in 2 weeks, you go back in 2 weeks. So I was very patient that way. I'm not sure I would have that patience anymore today, but I did everything I was supposed to do, and eventually I did get in. It wasn't particularly productive, but at least I knew how the system worked. And then, you know, I would start going to Vietnam more regularly. After I got my first job shortly after I graduated. And then over time, it became very slowly a little easier. But for several years after that, I would have to wait at least a month before actually reading documents. But I was always nice. I was always smiling. And now I'm at a point where I can show up in the morning and read stuff by the afternoon.
Oh, wow.
But we're talking about basically two decades of building relationships with the people at the archives.
And there's been a sea change in the archives. I mean, the pre-54 material took me almost 2 months to get in. I presented my papers on the first day and it was almost 2 months. So I worked in the National Library, kept coming back every week, and they politely say, come back next week. Eventually got in, and it was just so slow. Like I request, you know, they request all the documents you want. You can only no more than 20. So I request them, give them the list and say, okay, come back in 2 weeks. Only the documents could go back in one batch. I couldn't pick and choose.
Go back and look at stuff.
So then you can only, once you're done with all those documents, come back the next day, drop a new list, wait another 2 hours. Now it's lovely. The new archive building, you walk right in, the staff are much more friendly than they were to me in the 90s. And I was getting work done the first day. It was fantastic. So.
But I think that's the thing. So three is kind of like this for me now. But when young people come in, very often there's that element, right? I mean, that's the one thing. I look back upon the whole thing, and I'm kind of happy about the way I've dealt with things. You know, I was always nice. I never tried to bribe anyone, which some people said I should do, but I never wanted to do that. And now, especially now, I don't want to do it because, you know, if you start that practice, right, then you make it more difficult for grad students to then see the kind of stuff that they want to see.
Or you could potentially really offend
And you're someone. Right. So exactly.
I was told that too in the mid-90s. And so they told me, I don't know who it was. I should track them down. That said, okay, take a couple cartons of Marlboros, real Marlboro Reds, real American cigarettes. So, and I'm a militant anti-smoker.
I took
three cartons and got there and realized the last thing I was ever going to try to do was bribe anybody like that. Like, I don't even know how to do it. And like, just, it was, you know, they were very difficult, but very professional. So I wound up, for the year I was there, all these cartons of cigarettes, and I wound up just tipping them to the Zaum drivers, the taxi.
Yeah. What I do now, and what I've been doing is basically like a very Vietnamese thing, right? Is like I would go. I started doing that several years ago. I would go and do my research on the last day, bring either cake or fruit to thank them. Yeah, and so, right. So at that point, I don't need anything else. But here it is. And then the next time you come in, people remember, and I keep doing the same thing, or take them out to lunch on the last day. Right.
That is much more of a polite thank you.
Yeah, than exactly.
Like this weird sort of Western notion of transactional bribe that I was told. I was terrified. Anyway, I wanted to spend a good chunk of time in the podcast talking about that, because I don't know if most listeners or anyone who hasn't done research in Vietnam understands the obstacles.
Yeah.
There's the linguistic obstacle. Vietnamese is a very difficult language. And then there's simply the access to documents. In levels of difficulty that I think now in this post-Cold War world, most researchers don't really have to think about.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I don't know how it is but archives, you can't take pictures. So it's either, you know, it's pen and paper, which I'm fine with, because that's, or else you gotta petition again to get documents copied, and then that can be denied. Maybe you can see a document, but then it's not necessarily going to mean that they'll allow you to make a copy.
Right.
So it's all, and that's what's kind of interesting, is that you find that after people have gone to do research for their dissertation, they never go back. There's only a handful of us who are like kind of, I would call like senior professors, or who keep going to the archives, and we see each other every year, like Pete Zinnemann from Berkeley, Christian Lentz from North Carolina. Yeah. Mitch, you talked about, you know, or you were mentioning that Mitch Osso is one of the guys you've talked to. I see Mitch once in a while, but it's always the same people.
Yeah.
It's just a handful of us. And then otherwise it's just grad students.
The true archive rats.
Yeah, I guess so. Right. Because I mean, we have the time, maybe we have the financing, but I think we all in our different ways that kind of have the patience, you know, and so it's kind of one of the striking elements about working in the archives there. Yeah. But at the same time, when you keep showing up, the people there respect you in return. And that might Absolutely. Be why things Absolutely. Are a little easier,
Establishing
right?
Especially in professional relations.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you're a friend of the archive, right? Yeah. So
what did you find? I mean, to talk about the book a bit more generally at first, what were some of the big aha moments from this research? For, again, a subject that there's a large body of literature on.
So I mean, one of the elements that I think is kind of interesting, and that your audience might be familiar with, this whole idea of the Vietnamese having a long tradition of resistance to foreign aggression, right? And us in the West,
if you go to the Vietnamese museums, they tell you this. You go to the Army Museum in Hanoi, and they'll, you know, there's a clear line in that museum's narrative from resisting the Chinese occupation, the Mongols, all the way up to the Americans. It's you know, their narrative is, this is what the Vietnamese do.
Yeah.
Do not mess with us.
Exactly. And the thing is this, right? It's like when Americans teach about the war, that's usually the same narrative they recycle to explain why the Vietnamese won. Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking about a people that defeated the Chinese like 60 times, defeated the Mongols, defeated the French. So of course, they were going to defeat the Americans.
Yeah. Walter Sobchak in the Big Lebowski. a worthy adversary, right?
Yeah. So what people don't understand is that this whole narrative was actually fabricated by Vietnam's communist authorities during the early stages of the American War. It's a myth. This idea that the Vietnamese come together whenever they're invaded from the outside, it's just a myth. It's not supported by the facts of history, but it's a myth that was constructed during the American War and really very heavily perpetuated as a way of motivating people domestically, but also kind of suggesting to the outside world that the Vietnamese are a proud people. They're very, very nationalistic people. Again, all of which is untrue, right? Well, the Vietnamese are very proud, but the idea that somehow their nationalism developed earlier than others, this it's all myth. But so, you know, in terms of like the things that are interesting is that to me, it's like the we think of the Vietnamese, especially that these communist leaders, as, you know, people who came from the countryside who knew nothing about the world. Boy, they understood the world better than American leaders ever did. And they knew how to play that world. They knew how to manipulate public opinion domestically, internationally, through the creation of these kinds of grand narratives, which were so successful that even though the war is behind us, we still use them to teach the war. I mean, how many of us who teach the war haven't used that whole narrative of, or the Vietnamese developed nationalism early on? The Vietnamese had fought the Mongols, so of course they were going to beat the Americans. And it's all fabrication, yeah. and it's all a product of this construction by Hanoi of a grand narrative to justify
and
the war,
specifically in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's fat to me. In terms of like the things that kind of struck me as I was doing my research, on the one hand, it's just the knack of these leaders to create, to manipulate information to advance their purposes. It's just unbelievable. And I think this information war they wage goes a long way toward explaining why they win in the end.
I think they
prove much better than the Americans at manipulating information with a view to rallying, mobilizing support for their cause at home and abroad. You know, I mean, this whole
it's Clausewitz.
Oh,
it's,
yeah.
It's what war is an extension of politics.
Exactly.
Right? They're doing better at the political game.
And that's the key, Mike. That's the key right there. If you tried, you know, when people say like, well, if the U.S. could have bombed more, if the U.S. could have, I mean, by Hanoi's own account, a million North Vietnamese and Viet Cong troops died during the war. And then as we all know, right, about 58,000 Americans perished. So to me, ask any general, right, for 58,000, you kill a million. Will you take those odds? I mean, absolutely. So militarily, the U.S. did everything right in Vietnam. There's nothing more it could have done to win the war. But that's the thing, is that the Vietnamese, through political means and diplomatic means, were basically able to negate the impact of the military struggle. Mm-hmm. Because they recognized that this war didn't have to be fought on only one front, the military front, but could also be fought politically, domestically, and then diplomatically, internationally. Then they could more easily isolate their enemies and rally their own people. And that's, to me, that's the key. That's where the Vietnam War was won. It wasn't won on the battlefields of the South. It was won in the courtroom of public opinion within Vietnam and internationally, mm-hmm. through this clever manipulation of information. I mean, you know, this idea that, oh, you know, we're just poor Vietnamese who just want peace. And then, you know, these images of, if you look at the images that came out of Hanoi during the war, right, of North Vietnam, it's always a woman. Mm-hmm. It's always women.
Yeah.
Right. And all of this is deliberate. These photos of, you know, these big American POWs being escorted by females.
Very diminutive women.
It's all staged. You know, they would take the biggest POW they had, find the smallest woman they could find, and then dress them up, take pictures, and the world ran with it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
and still to this day. Project I'm working on now on history and memory in Southeast Asian museums about the Cold War. You go to the War Remnants Museum. And those images of like pilots that are about my size, 6'3", 250 pounds, being taken prisoner by a 4'8" Vietnamese farm girl.
Yeah.
I mean, they're striking images, and they really play on the gender component. But it's shrewd propaganda and shrewd moves.
But it worked. I mean, so basically, like, you know, you have this image of a very feminine Vietnam on the one hand, like, you know, unfairly victimized by the big bad Americans.
Yeah.
And that really went, I mean, from the very beginning, I mean, that's one of the obstacles the Americans had to overcome, which, I mean, I would argue they failed to do. I think that the problem with the way Johnson and Nixon managed the war is they never tried to make themselves accountable to the rest of the world to the extent that Hanoi did. Or at least they never tried to manipulate public opinion to the extent that Hanoi did.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. So it's a really interesting. So the information aspect of all of this.
Yeah. So you talked about how much of the American historiography is Nixon's war.
Yeah.
Or LBJ's war. So, you know, for primarily American listeners who know about the war, we know that on the Vietnamese side, it is Ho Chi Minh's war, and Ho Chi Minh ran the whole war. Uncle Ho, right? For he's the hero of the left and the enemy of the right.
Yeah.
So it's all Ho Chi Minh's war. And why are you laughing and giggling as I say this right now? Explain how
idea. So here's the problem, right? I mean, so for you're right. For most observers and students of that war, you know, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon's counterpart was Ho Chi Minh. So this was Ho Chi Minh's war, as you point out, right? So the number one problem with that is that even if you're not aware of what was going on in Hanoi, right? I mean, it was public knowledge from the time it happened. Ho Chi Minh died in 1969, right? And if you think about it, right, the war, let's say the American war begins in 65, right? Ho dies in 69. That's 4 years. But the war doesn't end until 75. There's still a lot of war left to be waged, right? I mean, more than half the war hasn't unfolded yet. Yet Ho Chi Minh is dead. And we all know this. How the heck can we claim this was Ho Chi Minh's war if he wasn't around for more than half of it on the one hand, right? Now, beyond that, When we look more carefully at the Vietnamese perspective, it becomes obvious, again, working from Vietnamese sources, that Ho Chi Minh wasn't even there at the beginning of the war. Essentially, what happens is this, right? So Ho Chi Minh leads the effort, the war against the French from 46 to 54, right?
You'll say that's his war?
That's his war. And that's really where he distinguishes himself. I think that's Ho's kind of golden moment here, right? And then in 54, in the aftermath of the big Dien Bien Phu victory, Ho decides to negotiate with France and then to accept the Geneva Accords calling for the partition of Vietnam at the 17th parallel. That, by the way, creates a lot of anger within the ranks of his own army and within the Communist Party. Many people thought that they should just continue the fight until they win everything unconditionally. But Ho thinks, no, we need a break. And then besides, you know, there's a sense that maybe diplomatically we can solve this, right? And then it's 54.
You describe him consistently as being moderate and cautious.
Yeah, he's very cautious.
Which
he's
are
very, very
really
cautious.
Interesting adjectives that I think challenge many America's received wisdom about.
No, absolutely. Uncle I mean, Ho. Even during the war against the French, I mean, he's very cautious. Like, for example, you know, before Dien Bien Phu, he's going to tell his general, the very famous Vo Nguyen Giáp, that you're only going to attack if you know you can win. Ho Chi Minh is emphatic about this. Like, if there's an ounce of doubt that we might not win, then don't attack. And sure enough, like I don't know if you were aware of this, but a day before Dien Bien Phu, the campaign was supposed to begin, Giáp canceled the whole thing.
This was in January, right?
Late January or something like that. But basically, because Ho Chi Minh goes to him, okay, so you're attacking tomorrow, but that's because, as I've told you, right, you're sure of victory, right? Then Giáp goes home, thinks about it, and says, Well, actually, I'm not sure. So he can't. He scraps the whole plan.
Well, postpones it.
Postpones it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Until
yeah.
When does the assault?
Until they start in March 7th.
Right. So
yeah.
For several months, puts this major assault on.
Yeah. And Zepp would write about this and call it, you know, my most difficult decision. Very dramatic. Yeah. But and then it's during that time that they kind of embed their artillery on the side of mountains, which did have a meaningful impact on the outcome of the campaign. Yeah. At any rate, So Ho Chi Minh really distinguishes himself during the war against the French. But then after that, there's a sense from within the party itself that he's making a lot of mistakes because he's too cautious. Like instead of continuing the war against France, he negotiates. And then when it becomes clear that the agreement, the Geneva formula, is failing, Ho Chi Minh refuses to resume armed struggle. And so it creates a tension within the party, and it allows for the rise of a faction I refer to as hardline or militant, led by this guy named Lê Duẩn, if you're not really familiar with Vietnamese. But at any rate, so this guy Lê Duẩn will essentially start this revolt within the party, which triumphs in 63.
And where's Lê Duẩn from?
He's from the South.
From the South.
Yeah, and
he's a Southerner.
He's a Southerner, and then he spends much of the war against France fighting in the South. And then when Ho Chi Minh accepts the Geneva Accords, basically, you know, the North has now been liberated, but the South returns to the French. So for Lê Duẩn and other Southerners, there's a sense that, well, why did we fight for 8 years, lose all these people? I mean, it's that there's tremendous anger among Southerners because, well, good for the North, it's now free, but what about us, right? And sure enough, you know, the regime in the South that's established after Geneva, the regime of Ngô Đình Diệm, really, really goes after communists who are now very vulnerable and have no measure or no way of protecting themselves. And this only kind of amplifies the frustration of Lê Duẩn and other Southerners who managed to survive these anti-communist campaigns initiated by Diem. So and over time, yeah, this consensus develops within the party that maybe Ho Chi Minh is not the right man for the job. And what I argue in the book is that essentially, within a month after Diem gets overthrown in Saigon in November of 63, there's a what I call a silent coup in Hanoi that leads to the overthrow of Ho Chi Minh and his replacement with this guy named Lê Duẩn. And Lê Duẩn is very shrewd, right? I mean, he understands that he can't kill Ho because, I mean, Ho has become the face of the Vietnamese Revolution. So what they do is they basically marginalize him. Yeah. They sideline him.
But I also point out that contrary to what we may think about Stalinist regimes, Ho Chi Minh did not kill Lê Duẩn.
No.
That's a really interesting section of the book, that there is that dissent allowed within the highest inner circle of the party. I mean, this is what democratic centralism is supposed to be, right? Discussion and debate within the highest ranks, but once the party line is decided, follow it, correct? Yeah,
exactly.
But he, like, it was unimaginable that this could happen in Stalin's Soviet Union
or
Kim, Mao's China.
Yeah, or Kim Il-sung's North Korea, right? I mean, it's yeah. But I think, and again, right, to me, that's further evidence that Ho was a moderate, right? Mm-hmm. That he's very flexible. He's not as, but then that's the thing. Yeah. Once Lê Duẩn takes over.
I think there were some Trotskyites in the 1930s who didn't think that.
You're right. Yeah, I mean, the 30s and mid 40s are very interesting in terms of the assassination of rivals.
Yeah.
But
go on.
But we get a much milder Ho by the mid 1950s. A Ho who's much more open to diplomatic solutions and engagement of his enemies, and that alienates some of the members of the party, including these Southerners and Lê Duẩn in particular. Yeah. But yes,
so how's Lê Duẩn's personality different than Ho Chi Minh?
So he's a much more taciturn character. This is a guy, you know, unlike Ho Chi Minh, who spent 30 years abroad and spoke, you know, French and Chinese and Thai and Russian and, you know, I mean, Lê Duẩn has never really been anywhere, except the South. You know, I mean, coming north for consultation was the most exhaustive
and
travel.
And he's one of these figures in the Vietnamese Communist Party that some of the most important lines on his resume are time spent in jail, right? French jails. Was he in South Vietnamese jail?
It was in various jails. Including some of the worst jails, the worst colonial jails.
And then that becomes really important in party leadership.
These
are people who are not hardened by long nights reading Das Kapital, but rather long years in suffering in these prisons.
And you bring up, and this is the thing that I think is important for the audience to understand, is that you know, all this focus on Ho Chi Minh and how great Ho Chi Minh is, within his own party, a lot of people never really cared much for Ho Chi Minh, which is very interesting. I mean, here's a guy who spends 30 years overseas traveling and then now we say, well, he was studying the revolution. But then during those 30 years, most of his comrades are dying, being, you know, incarcerated, being tortured, then the only reason Ho gets to assume leadership of the party starting in 41, 42 is because everyone else has been either killed or is in jail. So he's kind of an opportunist, right? I mean, he returns after 30 years in 1941 with everyone pretty much dead already. So then he can claim leadership of the Communist Party, but he'll always have his detractors.
Yeah.
And for people like Lê Duẩn, I mean, that's how I really think they were seeing Ho Chi Minh, that he's leading the party, he's a good face for the revolution, but he, you know, he hasn't suffered as much as we have. Yeah. He doesn't know Viet. I mean, 30 years abroad.
Yeah.
It's exceptional, but you know, this idea that he's such a nationalist. Well, if you're a real hardcore nationalist, what the hell are you doing spending all this time in France? And you know what I mean? And he's studying, but he's not fighting like some of these other guys are doing. I mean, Lê Duẩn is bleeding mm-hmm. on a regular basis. And here now he's supposed to play second fiddle to Ho Chi Minh. So in 63, given the chance, he takes over. And then the party assumes a very different identity. There's no tolerance for dissent. And now we see kind of the institutionalization of a real Stalinist regime where people get killed, thrown in jail for disagreeing with the party.
Under Lê Duẩn's leadership. So he comes to power in this bloodless coup in 63, late 63. And what is his title and what will he...
In 1960, officially he's first secretary of the Communist Party. But again, you know, even though he's got the title, it doesn't have the power because Ho Chi Minh is around. But by 63, he's got the title and the power. Mm-hmm. And then Ho Chi Minh ends up just being like a face of the revolution, much like Vo Nguyen Giáp, the famous general who plays no role during the American War being, again, just like Ho Chi Minh, a face of the revolution.
And somewhat of a moderate, right? Didn't he, after the disastrous land reform campaign, which is a whole separate issue we can't really get into, but Giáp came in and tried to sort things out.
But then once Lê Duẩn can't stand him. Lê Duẩn absolutely hates Vo Nguyen Giáp, in part because Giáp never spent the amount of time in jail that he and this other little clique of leaders who assume control of the party after 63 have experienced.
Well, Pierre and I, and probably many of our listeners, love Giáp because he was a brilliant man who started his professional career as a history teacher.
This
is our guy.
but that's the thing, right? I mean, and one of the things that Lê Duẩn will accuse Ho Chi Minh and guys like Giáp of is being basically of a bourgeois background and not really understanding what real suffering is.
Yeah.
So it all contributes to these changes that take place in 63, 64.
And Lê Duẩn will run the party and the country until his death in 1986.
Yeah, which is, I mean, 23 years. Yeah. And Mike, so this is the stunning part, right? Here's a guy who runs a country for 23 years, right? And I mean, and again, whatever, you know, Hanoi has tried to do in terms of like suggesting Ho Chi Minh was in charge the whole time. I mean, how can we ignore the fact that for 23 years, this guy basically was the general secretary of the Vietnamese Communist Party, why have we not paid closer attention to this? Why are history books constantly referencing Ho Chi Minh and Vong Nguyen Giáp when in fact this other guy is presumably the head of the party?
But it's but by his design, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like
they used Ho Chi Minh and to a lesser degree Vong Nguyen Giáp as these friendly figureheads. So I have to ask you, and I think I've observed this in action at a conference we were at in Hanoi a few years ago, where there was some kerfuffling and raised eyebrows. And a bit of a heated discussion when you were presenting your research conclusions. How has this analysis been received in Hanoi?
Well,
where there's pictures of Ho Chi Minh everywhere. When I was teaching in the 90s, I had a picture of Ho Chi Minh in my classroom. And finally told my students one day, as I got to know them pretty well, like, you know, it is kind of odd for me to be teaching this picture. And they're like, well, how could you look in his eyes? They literally said to me, look into his eyes. He's so kind and gentle.
Yeah.
This cult of personality truly is successful.
It really is. Absolutely. And they use it. And as you say, and Dezuan himself will try to perpetuate it because it serves his purposes. But so you talk about conferences in Hanoi, right? So again, when I was younger, I was always careful of what I would say. The older I get, the more comfortable I am saying what I really think. And usually what happens, it's a dance at the conference, right? I'll say my thing about Lê Duẩn and Ho Chi Minh being marginalized. My Vietnamese counterparts will suggest that publicly in front of other colleagues and students that, you know, Professor Asselin has studied Vietnam a long time, but there are some things he doesn't understand, including the great role that Ho Chi Minh played. And then we'll go have beer afterwards, and then I'll be told, you know, your points about Lê Duẩn, I agree with them, but we can't talk about them, right? Yeah. And then that's the thing, is that they'll tell me more about Lê Duẩn and things he did to sideline Ho to play the system. Yeah, yeah. And that's what I mean when I say this is the book I've always wanted to write. Because over the years, I've heard a lot of really interesting stories about Ho Chi Minh, about Lê Duẩn, about what's going on within the party. But of course, none of this stuff has been published. And as much as I've been able to access documents, I've never been able to access the real party documents that would shed light on these internal debates, right? But because I was writing a general history, I didn't have to reference every statement I made as we do in an academic monograph, right? So I think that the book is rich because of this, because you're talking about not just stuff I got from the archives, but stories I've been told, you know, which I know are true because they've been corroborated about what was going on, but which will never be published as long as Vietnam is under this particular system. Mm-hmm. So, this is really interesting. This will be really interesting, I think, for your audience. So we know a lot about Americans who got drafted and fought in Vietnam and you know, as opposed to the Vietnamese, which was the North Vietnamese Army, which was all volunteer.
Patriotic duty, all volunteers. Yeah,
right. Yeah. So it's true. It's absolutely true that overwhelmingly the young men in the North Vietnamese Army were volunteers. But in reality, it's slightly different. Essentially, what would happen is this, right? I mean, you go to class one day, you're 17, 18 years old, right? Teacher tells you, well, you know, the state needs you. So you're going to be drafted, right? Unless, of course, you volunteer now. You're likely to have a better position. You'll make your family proud. You'll make the nation proud. And so who wants to volunteer? And then Mike says, well, I'll volunteer. And then Pierre is Mike's best friend. Well, okay, and then that's basically, I mean, if you don't volunteer, you're going to get drafted, right? It's like, so you volunteer because it looks better, mm-hmm. right? Than waiting for your draft papers, which, as it turns out, when you talk to Americans, was very often the same rationale, right? There's a sense that
I know a number of individuals that same story.
So that's the thing, right? Because the sense is that if you wait to get drafted, for sure you end up infantry army. If mm-hmm. you volunteer, Maybe, just maybe, you end up on an aircraft carrier.
Or driving a truck in Germany like Elvis, you know.
Yeah, and it, of course, it really, if ever happened, but you had this idea, right? So that's the thing. So in this sense, it's an all-volunteer army when we talk about the North. But realistically, it turns out most people didn't want to be there. And we actually have now, there's a Vietnamese student who's done his PhD here in the U.S. who's looking at this. He's conducted interviews, basically underground interviews, mm-hmm. with North Vietnamese veterans. And basically 80% of the people he's talked to have confessed that they never wanted to become party to the war. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when he asked them, what would you call the war? Do you call it the American war? Do you call it, 80% call it something along the lines of that miserable war.
Yeah, that's not what I've seen in the propaganda.
Exactly, right? And this is again, like, in terms of how Hanoi, you know, was talking about information, right? And, you know, to those Americans who think, well, you know, it was their country, so they didn't mind sacrificing for it. You know, that the authorities in Hanoi don't reveal the extent of the casualties they suffered during the war until after the war. Yep. For much of the war, even if they know that a whole unit has been wiped out, they won't tell their relatives they're all dead.
Yep.
They'll suggest that, no, things are going great. We killed 5,000 Americans this week. You know, and if they report the death of an individual, it's usually to say, well, this guy died saving the lives of 200 people by throwing himself in front of a machine gun, right? So there's this, they perpetuate these notions that we're losing very few people and the Americans are losing people by the thousands. So and there's no way of verifying if that's true because Hanoi completely controls the flow of information into and out of the country, right? So, but then when the war is over, people expect their relatives to come home. They're not showing up. And only at that point do they appreciate the cost of that mm-hmm, war. Mm-hmm. Do they realize how expensive it was? So, but during the war, the fact that casualties aren't reported basically allows Hanoi to sustain popular support, at least to some degree, for its war effort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so people never in North Vietnam never see the body bags, right, as they do in the United States. Soldiers who've been seriously injured, seriously wounded, have to spend the rest of the war in sanctuaries in Laos, Cambodia, or in China. You don't want basically crippled.
Exactly.
Yeah, you don't want people missing limbs walking around.
Defeatism.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, what about the impact of the American bombing in the North?
So we don't know and this is one of the things that I've been looking for a long time. Mm. North, the authorities have never released casualty figures. My sense is that the bombing killed civilians, but not on the scale that we think. And the Vietnamese themselves will tell you this because, as it turns out, most cities were evacuated during the war. People were in the countryside, and that helped minimize the impact on the civilian population. But, you know, having said that, there's still thousands, possibly tens of thousands of civilians who die because of the bombing. But it was never, I think, on the scale that I think we've written about in our histories. This is kind of interesting. When in 1964, and we know this from the documentary record, when Hanoi is starting to send North Vietnamese combat units into the South, there's great concern about the fact that the civilian population up North does not care about what's happening in the South. We know this from the documentary record. Hanoi is concerned that as major combat operations are underway in the South, starting in late 64, early 65, before the Americans themselves join the fight, that the people in the North are not behind this. And so Hanoi is trying to figure out, how do we rally people? How do we rile people up so that they'll support the war, they'll volunteer to go and fight for the war? Mm-hmm. And Hanoi is really struggling with this until the U.S. starts bombing. The bombing really played into Hanoi's hands, in the sense that now people had cause to support the war and to volunteer to go and fight, right? So the American rationale for bombing northern Vietnam was that the North was supplying guns and troop support to the Viet Cong trying to overthrow the regime in Saigon. And yeah, perhaps that made the bombing legitimate. But the average man, woman in northern Vietnam had no idea of any of this. Based on what they were hearing from the authorities, they hadn't done anything, and the Americans, in typical angry imperialist fashion, had just decided to bomb them because that's what the Americans do. They bomb people for no reason.
Yeah, yeah. All that propaganda. I always think of that some village and, you know, outside of Ving or somewhere that, you know, they're getting the steady stream of propaganda about American imperialism, and that makes no sense for this small village until one day a B-52 comes by and incinerates half the village.
Suddenly,
that village is going to rally around the flag.
They will, and that's the thing, right? But so maybe the Americans are bombing the village because that's a transshipment point for supplies into the south. But quite possibly, if you're from that village, you weren't aware of that. And as far as you're concerned, this was you got bombed, you know, for no reason.
Yeah. And it's bombing is not an accurate science.
No, it's not. It's not.
And there's so many lies about air power in the 20th century.
We've had in a number of studies that have been published suggesting that the more you bomb, the more you embolden your enemy.
Absolutely. World War II.
Yeah. 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 Exactly.
Across the board.
Yeah. I mean, so, and there was a survey conducted by scholars at Cornell relatively recently that showed that enlistment into the Viet Cong spiked whenever the bombing of a certain area became more intense. Basically, the more you bomb, the easier it was for the Viet Cong to recruit fighters and partisans.
Interesting. So we're starting to push the limits of time, but could you say a few words on your discussion on the Tet Offensive? Because this is also something many of the listeners will be familiar with.
And yeah.
What did you discover about the North Vietnamese Communist Party's perspective on the Tet Offensive?
So you know, when we think about the Tet Offensive in the U.S., right, or in the West, it's like, is the turning point of the war, stroke of genius by the communists. You know, that's where they win the war, right? They deal this big psychological blow to the United States. The reality is the outcome we get is never the one that was intended by North Vietnamese policymakers. Mm-hmm. When they launched the Tet Offensive, and this is not Zap's, this is Lê Duẩn's offensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Vong and Zap is actually against it. He's against it.
Right.
Lê Duẩn wants this. And his goal is to basically achieve a decisive military victory. He's going all out. He's going for broke to win this one, to win the war once and for all, right? And of course, militarily, it's a disaster. It's a complete disaster. But we have the documents where the authorities outline their plan for the attack and the goals it's intended to achieve. And they're purely military objectives, right? There's nothing about a favorable diplomatic or political outcome. This is intended as a military campaign intended to satisfy purely military objectives. On those counts, it fails miserably. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about they commit approximately 100,000 troops to the effort, and about half of them die. I mean, they're not wounded; they die. About 40,000 casualties killed in action are suffered by Viet Cong, North Vietnamese armed forces. But then in the U.S., these images of the embassy in Saigon being under siege, of the chief of police executing a guy in broad daylight, turn this military disaster into a psychological victory, right? And then what happens is interesting. Then Hanoi comes out and says, "Well, of course that was the goal all along. Look," and then we look at it. Oh man, what geniuses!
Yeah,
but it was really after the fact that they decide to kind of highlight the psychological impact, which was never in the plans for the attack.
What was the impact of the Tet Offensive on the National Liberation Front, on the so-called Viet Cong, Southerners who are fighting in the guerrilla forces, as opposed to the PAVN, the regular army of North Vietnam?
It completely decimates them.
It destroys them.
And then you have something. So like Viet Cong units are completely gutted as a result of the Tet Offensive. So much so that to keep some units operational, the North Vietnamese army starts lending its soldiers to the Viet Cong. And as you know, right, after Tet, Nixon is elected, and then we have this process of Vietnamization of the American war effort, mm-hmm. right? So as Americans are pulling out, South Vietnamese soldiers and Marines are doing more and more of the fighting. What's happening on the other side is you have what I call a northernization of the North, of the communist war effort. With the Viet Cong being really decimated, you have more and more Northerners now doing the fighting.
Which gives Hanoi more control. Because, I mean, there's the National Liberation Front is not under as direct control of Hanoi as they probably, as Lê Duẩn would have liked, right?
No, you're right. I mean, it was always kind of a problematic. It was created by Hanoi, but sometimes it would have a mind of its own.
It's in the South, yeah. And they're Southerners, and they're doing their own thing. They're not rank and file part of the military.
But the big concern for Hanoi is this, though, is that now, so after Tet, you have more and more Southerners fighting on one side against more and more Northerners fighting on the other. And essentially we have a state of civil war, mm-hmm. and it's really North Vietnamese against South Vietnamese.
That's the real civil war after 71, 72.
Starting in 69 with Vietnamization and in the post-Tet, and this civil war, that was Hanoi's big fear.
Yeah.
Because you know, remember, right? Hanoi's main goal is national reunification.
Oh, so Hanoi would rather fight American troops than a legitimate South Vietnamese.
Absolutely. Yeah. For it looks much better domestically, and it looks much better internationally. But the moment you start killing other Vietnamese, that's when your cause loses much legitimacy. And to illustrate my point, right, Hanoi never had a hard time motivating soldiers to go to the South to kill Americans. After 69, as Americans are getting out of the picture, Hanoi is struggling with this so much so that it starts lying to its forces, saying that the Americans aren't really leaving. I found this great document in the Canadian archives from 1973, by which point the Americans have completely left Vietnam. The last U.S. combat forces left in March 73. So this North Vietnamese kid, a soldier, gets captured in June of 73. Right. And then he's detained by the South Vietnamese authorities. And then the Canadians are part of this commission that's supposed to look after prisoners, make sure they're OK. So I found the report in the Canadian archive. So this Canadian guy goes and meets with the POW, this North Vietnamese prisoner of war. And he says, are you well treated? Are they torturing you? This and that, blah, blah, blah. And then when he's done with this interrogation, he asks the kid, the North Vietnamese soldier, do you have any questions for me? And the Canadian said, the kid says, well, actually, sir, I have one question for you. Like, when I left Hanoi 7 months ago, they told me I'd be fighting and killing Americans. Before I got captured, I'd been here for 4 months. I never saw an American. Like, where are they? And the Canadian says, well, since the signing of the Paris Agreement, American soldiers have gone home. The last troops left in March of 1973. And the kid says, you're lying to me. The Canadian says, no, listen, like, you know, there was an agreement signed. No, the kid says, there was no agreement signed. You're lying to me. And leave. But you see, right? I mean, even though Hanoi keeps lying because it needs to motivate its soldiers. And Hanoi understands that it's much easier to motivate a kid by telling him you're going to be killing Americans than by telling him you're going to the South, you're going to be killing other Vietnamese.
Wow, that's fascinating.
It's deceptive. There's no question about it. It's deceitful. But does it work? Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. They win. They win in the end. So, and you know, war is war, right? You do what you need to.
Yeah. Well, This is fantastic. It's a great conversation. Thank you so much for your time. Before we let you go, what are you working on now? What's the next project?
I'm working on what I call a history of the global Vietnam War. Huh? I'm essentially right. So you know, we talk about World War I, World War II, and their global implications. I'm going to try to do that with the Vietnam War to show that when you look at the Cold War era, no war had more dramatic implications on the entire world than the war in Vietnam. So I'm going to look at the war itself, but then I'm going to look at its impact on American society, its impact on Western European society, its impact on the communist bloc, and then its impact on the Third World. So how Vietnam inspires revolutionaries in Nicaragua, for example, right?
Yeah.
How Vietnam contributes to the implosion of the socialist camp. How Vietnam is responsible for the rise of Euro-communism, right? And how Vietnam has an impact, let's say, on the civil rights movement in the U.S. or the feminist movement and so on and so forth. So just look at the Vietnam War as a kind of a global conflagration.
How it impacted a Canadian teenager when he saw the second Rambo film.
Exactly. But the impact on popular culture, the impact on music and so on.
Watch the original Hawaii Five-0 series. And the Vietnam background to that is so interesting and so important.
Is that right?
As is the relationship with the People's Republic of China. It's very, very interesting.
That's interesting. And
the writers were very savvy. I've actually written about it. I'll send you the piece. But it's there and in the background. It's really important. And, you know, I grew up on Oahu. And thinking about my childhood, I grew up in a militarized culture
because of
the war. I mean, we were one of the main staging bases for the war.
Yeah.
My home island. And that's an unusual childhood. We don't think about that in the same way.
Yeah, that's true. Well,
that's fantastic. I will let you go so you can get to work on that book, publish it, and we'll get you back on the podcast, okay?
Sounds good, Mike. Okay. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, thank you. This was great. So again, I'm Michael Vann. This has been a conversation with Pierre Asselin on his new book, Vietnam's American War, A History. This has been a podcast for New Books in History on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.